kind introduction by my good friend Gary Moore, who's one of the great stars of local government in Kentucky. As Gary mentioned, I started off in county government myself and used to come to these NACO meetings years ago. I'm very familiar with what it's like to be very close to your constituents. It reminds me of a fellow who was running for mayor of Louisville years ago, and he decided it was really going to be important for him to say that he'd be accessible, and so he handed out his home phone number, and sure enough, he got elected. And early in his tenure, the phone rang about 2 a.m. in the morning. He picked it up, and it was a guy who was obviously totally inebriated. He says, "That's you, the mayor?" I said, he groggily said, "Yes, it is. You did give me your phone number, right?" "I did." He said, "I got a pothole in front of my house. And you said you'd be responsive, and I hope you'll get out here and fix it." Mayor wrote down the guy's name, address, phone number. Next morning, having got as much sleep as he had hoped, went to the office, called the director of the works department, said, "We're going to show this community we're responsive. Go out and fix that pothole. Let me know when you've done it." Mid-afternoon, he called the mayor, said, "We fixed the pothole." That night, the mayor went home, set his alarm for 2 a.m. He called him up and said, "There, you SOB, we fixed your pothole." Now, I know you've been tempted to do that on a number of occasions. So was I. I resisted the temptation. But I know what it's like to be very close to your constituents. I want to touch on a couple of things today. First, the two things that I know you're focusing on, the opioid problem and the fact that we have done a multi-year highway bill. Opioid problem is enormous. Frankly, 2 years ago, when I asked the director Botticelli, who I understand has spoken to you, to come to Kentucky, I thought maybe we had a unique problem here because we had gotten the prescription drugs behind the counter and people had shifted to heroin, and I thought maybe it was tougher there than everywhere else. We've since found out it's a problem all over the country, and we're going to try to address that. Your Judiciary Committee has come up with a bipartisan opioid bill, which I intend to schedule very soon in the Senate. Let me just take you back to 2014 for a minute and tell you what's different about the United States Senate now. I had a challenging race in 2014, both in the primary and the general. When I was reelected, I might say, by a rather substantial margin, which I was pretty proud of. I had a press conference the next day, but it became apparent I was going to be the majority leader of the Senate. Now, you all know the difference between leading the minority and leading the majority. If you're a football fan, it's the difference between being the defensive coordinator and being the offensive coordinator. If you're the offensive coordinator, you get to call the plays. You've got a better chance of putting points on the board. So I used that analogy the day after the election, and I said, there are two issues that need to be dealt with here. One is the widespread feeling in the country that we were simply dysfunctional. It was true. It was absolutely true. Now, people may have been a little bit confused about where the dysfunction was, but the fact that we weren't accomplishing much was a legitimate issue. And I knew where the dysfunction was. So let me give you an example. In all of 2014, under the previous majority, we had 15 roll call votes on amendments in the whole year. There was one freshman Democratic senator who was defeated in Alaska who, in a full six-year term, never had a vote on an amendment on the floor. The place was simply shut down. For four of the previous 5 years, the Senate had not passed a budget, which is required by law. So I said, we're going to put the Senate back to work. I also said, we're not going to have any government shutdowns, and we're not going to have any threatening to default on the national debt. What we're going to be is a responsible right-of-center governing majority who tries to address the problems that can be addressed in a time of divided government. So let me touch on divided government for a minute. You know, the American people must like divided government because because we've had it more often than not since World War II. But so when you wake up and you find you have divided government, I think it's important to focus on what the American people may be saying. Here's what I think they mean when they elect divided government. I think they're saying, we know there are things you don't agree on. Why don't you focus on the things that you can agree on and try to make progress for the country? Now, in addition to that, in the Senate, for those of you who are political junkies, which I assume is most of you, 51 is a majority, but 60 is control, because most of what we do requires a supermajority of 60, which means there's not a whole lot you can do one party only in the United States Senate. The House, of course, is a majoritarian body, and the majority can get its act together and can do whatever it wants to. So I knew that in order to make progress for the country, I had to pick out things that had at least some bipartisan support. So we started with the Keystone Pipeline. We put it on the president's desk. Regretfully, he didn't sign it, but it was an example of something that enjoyed broad bipartisan support. We did, of course, pass the budget. We did trade promotion authority so that not only this president, but the next president would have the process in place to be able to submit a trade agreement to the Congress for an up or down vote. We did a complete rewrite of No Child Left Behind. Broad opposition developed over the years, and I'm sure in every one of your states, to No Child Left Behind, because it centralized so much power in Washington over education. We actually took power out of Washington, sent it back to states and local school boards all across America. And the president signed it. I think he was a little reluctant to sign it, but he did sign it. And it dramatically reduced the power of the Department of Education over sort of micromanaging every school district in America. And of course, we passed a 5-year highway bill, which I know you all cared about. Look, that hadn't happened since the 90s. We've done a series of short-term extensions. We passed a cybersecurity bill. We passed an internet tax moratorium, permanent. We've done Section 179 tax expensing measure, permanent. R&D tax credit, permanent. So, why do I keep saying permanent? The difference between permanency and extensions is, of course, nothing is permanent in Washington, but in order to change that, you have to pass the House, the Senate, and the White House. Getting permanent law is always better than an extension. So, what we've tried to do is to get back to work on behalf of the American people. Now, look, we do have our differences. They're significant. From my perspective, this president is the most liberal president since Woodrow Wilson. Why, if you're not steeped in American history, why do I pick Wilson? Wilson was a political science professor and president of Princeton and governor of New Jersey before he became president, and so he spent a lot of time teaching and thinking about government. And he thought the founding fathers actually made a big mistake when they made Congress as important as it was. He was a guy who was very much in favor of centralizing power in the executive. And so the reason I picked Wilson out is I think the president is the most liberal president since Woodrow Wilson and the most inclined to push the envelope on executive power. I had hoped we would have had a president much like Reagan or Clinton. Now let me tell you what I'm talking about. Reagan, of course, never had the House in 8 years. Clinton didn't have the House or the Senate of his party in 6 of his 8 years. So what did they decide to do? Well, they decided to move to the political center and try to accomplish some things that were big for the country. I'm going to give you some examples. Reagan and Tip O'Neill raised the age for Social Security. Nothing harder than that in American politics. Saved Social Security for a generation. Reagan and Tip O'Neill did the last comprehensive tax reform. We need to do that again. It's been 30 years. Bill Clinton and a Republican Congress did welfare reform and actually balanced the budget 3 years in a row in the late 90s. Very big stuff done in a time of divided government. So, my hope was that the president would move off of the far left and come into the middle and see if we could tackle some really challenging things for our country. I predicted it 3 times, and I've been wrong every time. In 2010, after the voters, I think, were seized with buyer's remorse after the $1 trillion stimulus and Obamacare and Dodd-Frank, they decided to change the House, and they made me the leader of a larger minority in the Senate. And I thought, well, maybe this is the time for a Clintonian pivot to the middle, but it didn't happen. After 2012, the president was reelected, but he was unable to flip the House. I thought, well, maybe now's the time for the Clintonian pivot. Didn't happen. Surely, I thought, after the 2014 election, when the president was confronted with a 100% Republican Congress, here's when the pivot comes. But alas, it did not. The president, shortly after the 2014 election, issued an executive order, for example, in the immigration field, which he had said on many, many occasions he didn't have the legal authority to do. The courts have since stopped him. We've seen the executive initiatives in waters of the U.S., something I think all of you care about. This is not a result of anything we passed. The Clean Power Plan of the president's, which the Supreme Court recently stayed, not a result of anything we passed. In fact, the so-called cap and trade issue was defeated when the president had 60 Democratic senators in the Senate back in 2010. None of this a result of legislation. The Clean Power Initiatives have created a depression in my state. We, in eastern Kentucky, it looks like the Dust Bowl in the 30s, all not as a result of legislation, but executive action. So what's the message you get here? The president wants to stay on the left. When he lost the Congress, he wanted to push the envelope as far as he could in the direction he wanted to go through the executive branch and challenge the courts to stop him if they would. In the case of the stay on the Clean Power Plan, you'd be interested to know who the lawyer for the coal industry is. Lawrence Schreib. If you haven't heard of Lawrence Schreib, he was the president's constitutional law professor at Harvard. A big liberal who thinks climate change is a problem, representing the coal industry in that case. Why? Because he believed what the president was doing not only violated the Clean Air Act of 1990, but was unconstitutional as well. Which leads me to the courts. We've had to resort to the courts to try to stop executive overreach, because our ability to do that without his pen is quite limited. There is a device called the Congressional Review Act, under which within 100 days after an executive action, you can, with an expedited procedure, overturn the regulation, but then it has to go to the president to be signed. And we've done that on several different executive initiatives, but of course he's not signed any of them. So his goal is to push the envelope as far as he can, all the way to the end of this 8 years, and hope that the country adjusts its behavior in all of these different areas to such an extent that it can't be pushed back. Which leads me to the final point I want to discuss with you this morning, which is the Supreme Court. About a week ago, we had a 1 week recess. My members were spread around the country. We heard about the unfortunate passing of Justice Scalia. For those of you who follow Supreme Court matters, a great man. He will rank up there with Oliver Wendell Holmes, John Marshall Harlan from Kentucky, and Louis Brandeis and others as the most significant associate justices in the history of our country. Huge, huge loss. The Supreme Court on many issues has been 5-4. And so it brings you to the question of what is the responsibility of the United States Senate in a situation like this. So we studied the question, and we are applying to this. The president certainly has the right to nominate, and I would do the same if I were him. But unlike these regulations, which we can only undo with his signature, the Senate has a role to play in this under the Constitution as well. The Constitution says the president shall nominate, and with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint to the Supreme Court. So even though the Senate cannot originate, it can respond to such a nomination. We looked at the recent history of the way these matters are handled, and we found first that it's been 80 years, since the Senate has confirmed a nominee to the Supreme Court when the vacancy was created in a presidential election year. 80 years. We also found that the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in 1992, the last year of the presidency of Bush 41, a fellow named Joe Biden, said that if the president sent up a nomination that year, the Senate would not act on it. We also found that my colleague Chuck Schumer, who's going to be the Democratic leader next year, I hope the minority leader and not the majority leader, said during George W. Bush's presidency that the Senate would not act on a Supreme Court nominee within 18 months of a presidential election. So, what I have said is that the decision on replacing Justice Scalia should be made by the American people through the process of electing the next president. The Supreme Court has frequently been able to operate with 8 members. This is not unprecedented. It does not shut down the Supreme Court. But this is a matter of extraordinary importance to the future of the country. Whoever makes this appointment will affect American life for probably the next 25 or 30 years or beyond, depending upon the lifespan of the nominee. So let the people decide. I think that makes the most sense. I'm confident that's where the Senate will end up. I'm not surprised that the president would make a nomination, but the Senate will not be filling that vacancy this year. And all of you will be able to participate through your selection of the next president in this decision of who should make this appointment. So that's sort of where we are. Summing up, I think we'll be able to make some progress this year, even though it is an election year and there are plenty of differences going on. But the talk you hear out there about dysfunction in Washington is no longer true. It was true a year ago, but the talking points of those who are saying that are a little outdated. And so the new majority is looking for areas where we can make progress for the country. Highways is a good example of that. The opioid problem is another example of that. Divided government is not unusual. We've had an election every 2 years since 1788, right on schedule. And I don't like people who say, oh, we can't do anything this year because there's an election. We're going to continue to try to make progress for the country, no matter who's in the White House and no matter who's in the majority. Let me thank you again for what you do on the front lines. Nobody's closer to the electorate than you are. And I immensely enjoyed my time in county government. It was a great learning experience. Local government is a fascinating experience, and I congratulate you all for being willing to accept the responsibility and, of course, accept the slings and arrows that go along with it. So I hope you have a great meeting. Thank you so much for having me here. Good morning, everyone. Thanks a lot.